This is your program, Historias, a podcast dedicated to the analysis of Latin American studies. In this program, we are interested in promoting dialogue between the Americas. We discuss books about Latin America published in English and Spanish. Today, we have the great pleasure of having Professor Brooke Larson. She's a historian of Latin American history. Her research encompasses 5 centuries of colonial and modern history with a regional focus on the Andes. Her first book, Cochabamba, 1550-1900s, provided a sweeping overview of Spanish colonialism and social transformations in the Valley of Cochabamba. That work, as well as her co-edited book, Ethnicity, Markets, and Migration, became part of a transnational interdisciplinary effort in the 1980s and 90s to reshape the dynamic field of Andean studies. A third book, Trials of Nation Making, took a wider comparative approach to the postcolonial problems and possibilities of nation making in the Andean republics of Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia during the 19th century. Today, we will be discussing her most recent work, The Lettered Indian, which is an ethnographic history of the battle over indigenous education and its implications for Bolivian nation-building projects and the contested meanings of race and citizenship over the 20th century.
Brooke, thank you so much for coming to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm so happy to talk to you, Carmen, because I admire your work in the history of Bolivia so much, and this is a delight to be able to talk about my new book.
We are delighted to have you here. You have worked on this book for a long time, and it represents your first major research project in the 20th century Bolivian history. So my first question is, what drew you to the subject of rural schooling? What was the book's origin story? And within Bolivia, why did you focus on the region of La Paz?
Well, you know, this is a good question, because I discovered Warisata one day, many years ago, when I was in the Columbia Teachers College, just browsing. And I picked this book up, and it happened to be the amazing memoir and ethnography written by Elizardo Perez called Warisata, La Escuela Ayu. And I read it, and I thought, this is a remarkable community school experiment. It's an indigenous school based on the aspiration of emancipation, community self-determination. Why is this so unknown outside Bolivia? Because I was very quickly discovering that Warisata had become something of a nationalist icon within Bolivia, but nobody knew about it outside of Bolivia. So I was very drawn to the topic of Warisata and realized that I had to get my tail back down to Bolivia as soon as possible in order to interview some of the surviving teachers and students who participated in the original school project during the 1930s, because by then, and this was in the early 1990s when I discovered Warisata, by then they were very old. And so that's what I did. And I began my research on rural schooling by interviewing a number of surviving teachers, artists, activists, and peasants who had been part of that early project. And I made friends with Carlos Salazar, Mostajo, and several other people. And I was so delighted that I was able to talk to them and begin my research while they were still on this earth to tell me about their experiences. And at the same time, I also discovered when I was working on this topic that there was a larger current of Aymara scholarship and activism going on in Bolivia in the 1980s and early 1990s. And so working with Silvia Rivera, Roberto Choque, Carlos Mamani, Esteban Ticona, and other people, based in La Paz, and members of the Taller de Historia Oral Andina, TOA, I realized that Wadi Sata really had deep roots in an earlier, wider movement of Aymara caciques who were fighting for their right to lands, but also schools. And so it all began to come together as a major movement that was unfolding across the Altiplano, beginning in the early 1900s, culminating in Wadi Sata in a certain way, and then moving on after the demise of Wadi Sata and springing up in new ways and in different venues, particularly during the 1940s and during the revolution of the 1950s.
That is so interesting. You are well known as a historian who has contributed to colonial history to the 19th century, but I love how this project connects with something that you started doing almost like at least three decades ago. So I find this connection very interesting. So your book opens around the 1900s by examining the liberal oligarchics project to deliver public instruction to all school-age children, including rural indigenous children. Yet you also argue that the liberal project of rural schooling was ultimately sabotaged by those same Bolivian elites, many of whom were openly hostile to the idea of indigenous schooling. So I wonder if you can elaborate on these key ideological debates that brought the vexing questions of race, nation, and education into play.
Yeah, this is a really interesting period in Bolivian history because historiographically, the liberal period between 1900 and 1920 is considered the golden age of early educational reform. And yes, there were really important efforts to build a public school system under the federal state, because most schools at that time were controlled by the municipalities, and there were very, very few schools, primary schools in the rural countryside for indigenous children, in spite of the fact that that was where the greatest need was, in that 80% of the population around 1900 still could not read or write in Spanish. So there were important reforms, or at least attempts at reforms. And two things come out of this period in terms of educational policy. And then I want to talk about some of the debates. But first, there came a program in rural education that was separated from urban schools. So the first pillar of public school education in this period is to divide public schooling into two sectors, the rural indigenous sector and the urban mestizo sector. And that divide, that you could call it segregation, was fundamentally unequal. It was based on the idea of inequality that indigenous peasant children did really not need a full education, that they needed just a minimum 2-year cycle, basic literacy, immersion in patriotic sentiments, you could say. So this was an institutional rule, you could say, that was solidified by 1920 and really endured for most of the 20th century. That is to say, rural schools under the federal state were segregated and unequal, underfunded, you could say actively underdeveloped. And that was really, I argue, a fundamental pillar of the continuing caste system, quality of racial geographic class inequality that isn't dismantled really until, well, it's dismantled partially during the revolution because rural education becomes a real priority, but it isn't dismantled institutionally until the late 20th century.
And hopefully we're going to cover some of those discussions about the revolution a little bit later in the interview. But now let's switch to what happened. It's still in the 1900s. And in chapter 2 and 3, you leave the urban metropole and you switch perspective and you focus on the indigenous hinterland. And there you argue that it was not the Bolivian state, but the rural Aymara community that emerged as the driving force behind a grassroots school movement during the early 1900s. How and why did Aymara peasant communities pursue their right to rural schooling, even in the face of anti-Aymara rural terror and repression? And what was the cultural use value of literacy and schooling in rural Aymara society at that time?
This is a very interesting part of the story, because this is where I get into the Aymara scholarship that was beginning to flourish in the 1980s and 1990s, where TOA scholars were going out into the field and creating oral testimonies of people whose ancestors or who themselves had experienced the earliest efforts to build their own community schools, often at great danger and great risk to their own safety in the face of hostile landlords and gamonal bosses in the provinces. But what we see is this, and what I'm arguing here in chapter 2, is that really the driving force behind rural schools comes not from state efforts that I was describing before, because they were mainly stymied and often opposed by the sectors of the conservative elite themselves, particularly the landholding elite. So that where we do see schools cropping up, and these are, you know, very underfunded, you could say, but community-supported rural schools called escuelitas unitarias or alphabet schools, they're coming out of the efforts of the communities themselves, and they're being promoted, sustained and defended by caciques apoderados, who increasingly are pairing their struggle for lands based on their original colonial land titles in the courts and the congresses and the newspapers. They're pairing that struggle for land with an emerging and new struggle for schools. And why schools? Because schools for them, in the context of this larger struggle over land and over autonomy and the right to exist as communities, necessitates skills and intermediaries who can work with the paperwork that's involved. They need to be literate. They need to be able to litigate their land titles. They need to do research in archives to get those land titles so that they could be litigated in the first place. They circulate documents, they dabble in print cultures, they set up rural schools. And all of this is part of the larger cacique apoderado movement backed by their own communities in the struggle to defend and restore the rights to communal landholding and the rights, really the cultural rights to exist and to thrive as indigenous peoples within the Bolivian state.
Which connects me with the powerful title of your book, The Lettered Indian.
Yeah, The Lettered Indian, El Indio Letrado. This is a trope, I guess you could say, that's full of ambiguity and contradiction. On the one hand, El Indio Letrado strikes fear in the heart of the elites. It's considered the lettered Indian is considered to be a dangerous element in the countryside, precisely because they're using literacy skills to defend their lands and to challenge the legitimacy of the landholding oligarchy. So it's considered to be, in a way, something that must be suppressed. The lettered Indian is a danger. On the other hand, within the indigenous movement, the Aymara movement, the lettered Indian becomes, you know, is the scribe. It's the cacique who becomes the interlocutor between these two cultures in this struggle for lands and rights to schools. So the El Indio Letrado, in this view from below, is really a a lettered warrior, an indigenous person who has mastered skills of legal paperwork, of communication in print and in the spoken word, where they're rising up really just.
Later, you focus on the famous, and you already mentioned Warisata, the famous Escuela Ailu. This was a decade-long experiment in intercultural schooling. And of course, this plays a huge chapter in your book. Warisata, as you mentioned already, was an iconic and is an iconic symbol in Bolivia today. Your book roots it in the earlier cacique school and land movement. In the chapter, you chronicle the tensions and collaborations among local Aymara people and progressive white and mestizo teachers, a joint effort that built a sprawling network of rural schooling during the 1930s. So what kind of your sources did you use to tell this ethnographic story of the Escuela Ailu? And looking back, I wonder if you can consider what was Warisata's most significant social and cultural achievements, and also its more complicated or gravest setbacks.
Yeah, well, that will take about 3 hours, but this is a very rich story. You know, it's a paradoxical because Warisata is so well known within Bolivia, as mentioned before. It's iconic. It's legendary. Every year its anniversary is celebrated in the media. And yet it's really still unknown in many ways. There are so many facets. As I was beginning to work on this chapter, which actually two chapters in the middle of the book, I realized that there is so much more to be done on this topic. And in some ways, its very fame in the public sphere, in the public sector, has obscured the depths, the complexities, the richness of this history that still awaits a new generation of Bolivian historians mainly to explore. And so I really hope that this book, once it's translated into Spanish and circulates in Bolivia, will, with several other books, encourage a new generation to really probe this this vein, to follow this vein of historical research, because there's so much more to be done. Just for this book alone, I combined oral testimony with newspapers, with government records, with pedagogical tracts, with indigenous petitions, with protest literature, and all sorts of artistic and literary work being produced and stimulated or inspired by the Warisata Escuela during the 1930s. So this is a 10-year experiment. And so it generates tremendous amount of rich source material, including private archives of Carlos Salazar and Eliseo Sardo Perez, which still have not seen the light of day, although researchers can arrange to work in those private archives, I believe. In any event, let me go and just point out three things that I think are most extraordinary achievements of Warisata and that of this Escuela Ayu during the 1930s, during its heyday. The first is that this is, first of all, you have to realize that Warisata is created in the middle of Omasuyos, a province known for its Gamonal political culture based in Achacachi, you know, a town of provincial potentates who practically rule over the countryside. It's also quilted by semi-feudal estates. So the landholding oligarchy is very entrenched in this area. It's incredible then that a school could carve out an oasis within this regional economy and political culture that creates the space for genuine self-governance and education to flourish. And so what we see here is a microcosm of Aymara cultural sovereignty that manages to survive for 10 years. This is a school that governs itself essentially through the Parlamento de Amautas, or the Council of Elders, and it establishes its own working tribunal of justice wow. rather than having to submit to the corrupt courts of Achakachi. And even more than that, it creates a deep civic space for communal assemblies, for an Aymara democracy to flourish, where indigenous leaders can speak openly about the oppression of the indigenous race and their rights to education, to citizenship, and to justice. And that doesn't happen too many places. And this is just where the voice of self-determination really flourishes. The second thing that I think is really notable about Wadi Sate is that it doesn't stay still. It expands its radius of pedagogical and political influence. It creates a whole network of auxiliary primary schools in outlying areas that are allied with the mother school, which is the Wadi Sate itself. These are called núcleo escolares eventually. That's how it's formulated. And they spring up in other regions as well. And they take different forms and have different achievements and problems, etc. But Wadi Sate itself remains the central núcleo escolar in Bolivia, the original one. And it is at its height, it is a center of a sprawling network of rural schools that's based on the idea of reciprocity. So the outlying satellite schools receive teachers and protection and guidance and some material support from the mother central school of Wadi Sate. And Wadi Sate in return often receives a stream of students for its secondary and normal school, but also resources that it needs to continue building and planting and creating its boarding school and its outlying farming schools. In other words, it's reconstituting a territorial dimension of indigenous solidarity and autonomy. Yeah. And finally, by the late 1930s, Wadi Sate, for all these achievements, becomes a mecca and a meeting ground for radical indigenistas, for leftists, for teachers, and for indigenous people from other provinces that flood into Wadi Sate on certain days, often civic holidays, to just see for themselves the incredible achievements that this school has been making and what it stands for. In a way, this becomes a symbol of Indian emancipation, not through revolution, not through violence, but through self-determination, through education, and through community, innovative community, community building and solidarity networks. And it eventually, its fame spreads throughout Latin America. We see a stream of pilgrims, I call them pedagogical and leftist pilgrims, flooding into Wadi Sate to look around, to learn from it, to take back inspiration and ideas to their countries. People come in from Peru, Ecuador, Chile, Mexico, and even the United States. And I would argue that it's the fame and influence of Wadi Sate by 1937, 38, 39 that also, ironically and sadly, sentences the school to punishment and decline that eventually, that makes it look in the eyes of Bolivian conservatives to be a nest of communists, a nest of radicals, teachers who are called racists, who are talking about race war against the white Gamonal class of the white landholding elite, etc. And so Wadi Sate, at a height of its fame, is also now entering a period of great vulnerability and ultimately destruction.
It's really a unique and remarkable story. Continuing with the question of what is Sata, I wonder if you can expand a little bit more about the reactionary oligarchic's effort to discredit and dismantle what is Sata in the 1940s. What was the rationale behind the state's demolition of the Escuela Ayllu? What measures did it take? What role, if any, did the U.S. play in Warisata's fall from grace?
Well, that would take a long time, but basically Warisata was considered to be a radical anti-white project of Indian emancipation. I would say that Warisata's flourished in a way as long as it had the tacit support of the populist regimes of Presidents Toro and Bush, that is to say, in the post-Chaka War era. In those years, the state was tolerant of Warisata to a degree, even though the landholding class and Achacachi's political bosses were increasingly hostile to Warisata. But once President Bush died through suicide in 1939, and the conservative oligarchy rushed back into power, it was clear that Warisata's days were going to be numbered. Already by 1940, and in the very International Congress of Indigenistas that was meeting in 1940 in Mexico, in Pátzcuaro, Mexico, already, even there was growing critique on the part of a faction of Bolivian conservatives that opposed Warisata and everything it stood for. How did they attack it? Well, once that Indigenista Congress was over, the oligarchic regime of Peñaranda began to mount a propaganda campaign and a legal judicial campaign against Warisata. And they attacked it in various ways by accusing Elizardo Pérez and its other leaders and teachers of corruption, of ineptitude, of inciting peasants through their communist ideas, etc. So it had to be eliminated. In the meantime, they blockaded the school, and local landowners began to pillage the school. They drove teachers out and basically shut down the school for a while, and then took it over and turned it into something entirely different. So by 1945, 1946, really Warisata, as we know it, no longer existed. It was brought back to life, but it was brought back under the guise of the state and later the United States, which turned the núcleo escolares into other kinds of schools that were based on exactly the opposite kind of pedagogical purpose that the original school had represented. In other words, instead of Indian emancipation, the núcleo escolar in the late 1940s, under the guise of U.S. and Bolivian state funding, was turned into a school of racial assimilation and modernization.
In your exploration of the 1940s, the role of the U.S. comes up. So I wonder if we can focus a bit on this question. And I wonder why and how does the U.S. step into this picture of indigenous and peasant education in the 1940s? And what was behind North Americans' sudden interest in Bolivian Indian schooling? What pedagogic tools did it use to affect behavioral change and rural modernization?
Well, you know, this I never expected, you know, how you get involved in these long research projects and suddenly it goes off in a direction you had never anticipated. And that's what happened here because, I set out to study an indigenous school and lo and behold, I'm finding that North American aid workers and educators and diplomats of all kinds were flooding into Bolivia, or streaming into Bolivia in the 1940s. But Washington's original interest in Bolivian workers, and therefore Bolivian indigenous workers, had to do with the tin mines, because, of course, the United States needed Bolivian tin for its war effort. And so it was very concerned about the militancy of Bolivian mine workers. And lo and behold, discovered that most of those mine workers were of indigenous descent. Ergo, the problem was to put the anthropologists at the Smithsonian Institute and other and universities onto the question of who is the Bolivian peasant? What is this Indian problem that Bolivia seems to have? And how is the Indian problem compounded by poverty, racial backwardness, the threat of anarchist communist provocation, et cetera, et cetera? How can we domesticate, tame, and train up the Bolivian Indian to be a disciplined modern workforce, not only in the mines, but also in the countryside? And that leads into the early Cold War era, when suddenly rural development becomes a big tool. Rural development and aid and expertise, U.S. aid and expertise, become tools of American foreign policy, particularly in terms of preempting communist threats by raising up the peasantry and the working force and giving them enough aid and training in order to secure a calm domestic labor force. And so this early Cold War era of U.S. funding, we see beginning in Bolivia and Peru, Ecuador, and elsewhere, with U.S.-funded rural extension education schools. That becomes the tool, the main tool of U.S. aid in rural education, because rural education has been now identified as a way to reach indigenous communities and really build an infrastructure that will turn indigenous people into efficient agricultural workers, their men, and indigenous women into modern hygienic housewives. So carried out through U.S. educational aid programs, this rural education program, as it was called, really penetrates certain indigenous communities, selected communities in the Altiplano, et cetera. And Wadi Sate is going to be one of them. This extension, as it was called, rural extension program, really penetrates not just the school, but the community, the family, and the body. And I call this intimate modernity, which is a kind of quiet episode of cultural imperialism that's happening right in the midst of growing peasant unrest throughout the Bolivian highlands. It's kind of a sideshow of the Indian education story that most scholars haven't really recognized yet.
Let's focus now on your last chapter, which is your chapter about the revolution, the 1952 National Revolution. And I love this chapter because it really captures the vitality of this era and how the country's political dynamics change after the revolution. Just to start, your work fills a void because most of the scholars have focused on land reform and nationalization of the mines. So my question is, how do you think your book alters our understanding of sociocultural change that is swept through rural Bolivia in the 1950s by focusing on the question on schooling?
That's a big question because this is a long chapter. The revolution, as you know, because you've written yourself a really wonderful and very important book on the agrarian reform and the agrarian struggle for reform. And in a way, this is a parallel struggle. It's interconnected intimately, as you know, and as I try to argue, but most emphasis until now has been on the agrarian reform itself, the land reform, the struggle for land, as well as, of course, the nationalization of the mines and some other, but it's the cultural politics of this revolutionary era that really interests me. And that once I began working on it, especially as I began to realize, and you've seen this, a tsunami of peasant petitions and mobilization, autonomous mobilizations for land, for schools, for all manner of justice, which can add up to citizenship rights, including the vote. When I began to realize the revolution going on from below, particularly between 52 and 55, I realized that this was the tail end in certain ways, or at least a high point, of 50 years of struggle for schools. It sort of culminates at this moment. And it culminates not only because it's built up a head of steam through thick and thin, all through triumphs and setbacks, all through the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, but it also culminates because the circumstances suddenly are favorable in a historic way. It's the circumstances of this moment. It is the fact that there has been a revolution. There is an unfolding agrarian reform, which totally shifts the balance of power in the countryside, basically eliminates the autonomy and the power of the landed oligarchy, and opens up spaces for indigenous communities to fight for parcels of land, to even fight for the restoration of their communal lands. So that's a sort of another aspect of the agrarian struggle that Carmen studies. It also opens up spaces for agrarian unions to be formed, a goal that has been escalating since the 1940s peasant movement. And it's also a space for finally indigenous communities to set up their own schools, and more importantly, to start to lobby and press the government to step up its own obligation to promote rural primary schools for all school-age children. Something that was promised in the 1874 Constitution, but of course was never instituted, never fulfilled. The promise was never fulfilled until this moment, when the possibilities and the horizons really begin to open up. So that's what I see happening, and you can see it manifested in the mass petitions, in the underground school networks that flourish, in rural teachers, in the multiplication of rural schools of all kinds in the countryside, some of them state-sponsored, but many, many of them funded by communities and unions, et cetera. And you see it also in a new intelligentsia of Aymara and Quechua peasants who have stepped into the breach and are beginning to articulate the demands of rural communities across the highlands and valleys. I was thinking what I would do is read a couple of paragraphs from the book that talks a little bit, tries to capture a little bit more of the essence of this chapter and my arguments, to read a couple of long paragraphs from the book. From the margins, we can perhaps take the pulse of indigenous aspirations in the communal act of building a local school without the fear of landlord retribution, in the heightened demand for rural teachers and schools, government aid, and NGO collaboration, in the scramble for popular literacy and schooling, and in the outflow of indigenous youth to the cities in search of new educational and livelihood opportunities. Amid the political ferment, the prosaic village school became a potent symbol of dignity, autonomy, and inclusion. On the Bolivian Altiplano, where Aymara communities had long struggled for community schools and cultivated a tradition of vernacular writing, the revolutionary promise of redemption was enshrined in the schoolhouse. It represented the aspirational space wherein indigenous children would be released from racial oppression of, quote, ignorance and, quote, illiteracy, denied their constitutional right, illiteracy, by learning how to read and write in the dominant language. Historically denied their constitutional right to formal schooling and punished by local potentates or state violence for having tried to claim it, rural people now had a chance to redeem the sacrifices of their forebears. At the most prosaic level, then, the pursuit of cultural empowerment and emancipation came in the shape of the alphabet reader, Then I go on to talk about some of the setbacks and difficulties, but I want to end our interview with one more paragraph. Looking across the long arc of social history, it is hard not to perceive in this half century of battle over Indigenous education, a high watermark in Bolivia's cultural politics of revolution. Even before the MNR state could erect an apparatus of popular nationalism and education reform, the rural school had surfaced once again as an impromptu yet potent symbol of Indigenous freedom from slavery and illiteracy, the twin evils of the racist colonialist order. As the age of agrarian and education reform unfolded in tandem, the village school opened new horizons of possibility for the Aymara children of 52. Indian peasants had established a precedent on which to build their ambitions and demands for social revindication. For the revolution's children and youth were in a crucial symbolic way the cultural heirs of the famous caciques of the 1910s and 20s, the once celebrated emancipatory school movement of the 1930s, and the militant peasantry that fought for rural unions, schools, and citizenship through the 1940s. And they too would leave an emancipatory legacy for their heirs. Eventually, towards the tail end of the 20th century, the Bolivian state would finally have to accommodate the country's vibrant multi-ethnic heritage and bank on the possibility that the country's ethnic diversity was not the scourge of the colonial past, but potentially its greatest cultural asset.
Brooke, I know that we are only scratching the surface of the book. So I want to thank you for the interview. And I also hope that this interview is going to encourage people to buy the book, because there is so much in this book.
And we just start discussing
a little bit of all your work.
Carmen, thank you so much for your questions. They were a very rich set of inquiries and made me think a little bit more about what I need to pull out of this book to make the points that I'm trying to make, the arguments I'm trying to make. So it's a great pleasure, and especially because I so admire your own work, and we have so much in common, really, in our scholarships. So thank you.
Brooke, thank you once again for this interview and your kind words. Before ending the program, I would like to refer to the song with which we started this episode. It is a powerful piece in Aymara titled Hachauru, which translates to The Great Day by Mario Gutierrez. This song has been used by the Aymara social movements in Bolivia as a symbol of their political and social demands. That is all for today. Until the next time.